Welcome to episode 8 of The Art of Med School, where we help creative minds understand medicine. This episode, we're talking about how coagulation works, food, and interesting special sense things.
Ooh, I can't wait.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because, like, So I didn't know that you were going to do food, and then I decided to do some stuff on special senses, which includes tasting.
Oh, that is special.
Weird how that works, right?
That's adorable.
Oh, that, yeah. You try and turn everything into, like, some sort of, like, romantic love thing.
I have to do that because you don't do it willingly.
No, well, it's because you go overboard. Like, oh, we...
I have to be romantic for the both of us.
Both of our shoes are untied. That's so sweet.
Oh, my God. I also do it because it kind of annoys you.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. So what's good this week? What's new?
Well, today is Heroes Day.
Yes.
It's a national holiday.
Yes.
I was asking people yesterday at work what Heroes Day was all about. Apparently... nobody really knows. They're like, oh, shit. Oh, crap. I learned about that in primary school. I don't remember. Apparently, some guy died. That was important. I'll try to find something interesting and actual, and maybe I'll do just a short blog post, or I'll post about it.
Oh, that'd be cool. Actually, it might be neat to do one of your sections, do the history of St. Vincent.
Oh,
like,
cool.
Like an annotated history.
Yeah,
you can do it as a... bonus episode.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I suppose let's, because we always seem to go over. We're trying really hard to keep it to, like, that 35-minute area.
Doesn't work.
No, we're not even close. And I feel like if anybody knows us, that they're probably not surprised at all.
Stop talking about how you don't want to talk so much and keep talking about something new.
Okay. So, talk about the coagulation. That's what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So, let's talk about coagulation. So, we talked about blood last week, and we started going into coagulation a little bit, and we decided we'd make it its own episode. But coagulation, like, it's kind of a really cool idea that when you cut yourself, your blood coagulates and stops the bleeding, but it knows to do this. And, like, what stops your blood from coagulating when you don't cut yourself?
Well, I'm sure it has, like, sensors and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's all. Of course it does. But isn't that kind of a crazy idea that your body, your blood can self-regulate like that?
Yeah, I suppose especially when you have, if you have, like, a hematoma. Or a bruise.
Yeah.
That's a bruise.
It's a hematoma. I was just waiting for you to see where you go.
And that you've obviously got an injury happening that you're not coagulating internally then.
Yeah, I mean, well, hematomas can be leaked blood and not, like, bleeding, too,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you remember when we talked about endothelium? All the different, like, there's columnar and squamous.
Oh, yeah.
And how it lines a lot of stuff. Well, your blood vessels are lined by endothelium.
Okay.
Okay, it's by the thin, squatty ones. The thin, like, the squamous ones.
Okay.
So, what those have in them when they line the blood vessel is they contain, like, chemical signals that are like flare guns. They're like the oh crap signal.
Oh yeah, you talked about those last week.
Yeah, the cytokines and stuff. So when one of those cells is ruptured, it releases those signals to say, hey, we have
danger, Will Robinson.
Yeah, and so we need to coagulate in this area. So if a cut is deep enough, it's going to hit, like, the basement layer of the skin, and then there's this, it's going to rupture some of that endothelium that's part of the blood vessel, and there's a glycoprotein, which is just like a protein mixed with a sugar, and it's called von Willebrand factor, which I think, yeah, I know,
we
right?
We need to figure out who this von Willebrand was.
I feel like you have to automatically do, like, a finger mustache with that.
Von Willebrand.
Finger mustaches don't really work for me, because I have a mustache.
That's true.
But so the von Willebrand factor, it's exposed to the circulating blood, and that's how platelets know that it needs to start sticking. In fact, platelets, which we know, I think most people know, are responsible for clotting. They have this
I knew that at one point in time. I totally forgot. Now I remembered.
No, that's fair. It has its own glycoprotein called 1B, which sticks to that von Willebrand factor. And that von Willebrand factor adheres to, remember we talked about collagen, like all the different connective tissues and stuff like that? So that connects to molecules of the connective tissue around, like, the blood vessel. So basically the point is that when that endothelium is cut, it releases this von Willebrand factor, which essentially grabs the platelets and starts holding them there. Like, I kind of think of it in Cliffhanger, where he's holding on with, like, one hand to the cliff, and then the, whatever the woman was, he's got, like, her hand on the other one, and he's, like, dangling there by one hand.
I don't know. That moment happens in a lot of things. So yeah, I'm totally true. Thinking of, like, Roadrunner cartoons.
When are they holding on to someone else? I feel like in Roadrunner cartoons, it's just the two and they're trying to hurt each other.
No, yeah. I mean, not another person, but, like, I don't know. Like, the coyote's always holding... The coyote. Oh, my gosh. The coyote is always holding on to, like, a knife or... I don't know. Shut up.
Anyway, this process is called the platelet reaction, and then those platelets that are sticking, we call them activated. So they form just like this weak sort of platelet plug, and they flatten out and they break apart, releasing ADP, which is, you know, like the used up version of ATP, which is energy, right? Calcium ions, a bunch of other stuff, and the smooth muscle of the blood vessel, when all that stuff is released, actually contracts, because they need ADP and calcium ions are like signals to, that's the chemicals they use to contract, and so that makes just that area, just that part of the blood vessel contract.
Okay,
so now that we've constricted the flow, we have less blood flowing through, so
we're not losing blood.
Yeah, we're gonna bleed less. Yeah. It also releases some signals, like those cytokines we talked about, that actually initiate, like, chemotaxis. It's like a flare gun that causes other platelets to come over and help.
Oh.
Right? So they're, like, rallying the troops here. And so as everything sticks together, you know, the number and the size increases, and then we have what we call the primary hemostatic plug, or the platelet plug. It's the weak plug. It's basically we've put a plug in that... In that cut to stop the bleeding, but it's not like an awesome plug. It's just decent enough for now. So then it gets, but what it does is it does get the coagulation cascade rolling, which is a whole mess of factors that we won't go into. But the coagulation cascade, its job is basically to take fibrinogen, which is a tissue, or not a tissue, a chemical, a protein, and which, like, cements around it, and that gets converted to fibrin. But basically, the job of the coagulation cascade is to take that weak platelet plug and make it a strong one.
Stitch a blanket around it.
Yeah. I think of it more as, like, spackle.
Oh, yeah.
And it only takes about 15 to 20 minutes. In fact, regular bleeding time for a hemostatic plug is usually in that 2 to 7 minute area.
Well, that's why when I closed my finger in the car door when we were going into town the other day, and my finger was all bleeding, and I was like, my finger hurts, and you're like, you'll be fine. And I'm like, I know I'll be fine. And then once we got to town, you were like, well, it should be starting to be coagulated by now, because work is about a 20-minute drive away.
Yeah. And, you know, that bleeding time is something that we keep track of, because it helps us understand how someone's blood is working. So, like, you know, hemophilia will have a different bleeding time, and if the bleeding lasts longer before you can tell that there's a platelet plug, or after the platelet plug has been formed, I mean, there's ways to keep track of all of that. It's kind of really an interesting concept.
So, you brought up hemophiliacs. just briefly right there.
Yeah.
What I've noticed so far from listening to you is that there's usually an equal and opposite thing on the other side. Is there, like, super clotters?
No, because they're dead.
Huh?
The people who over-clot, they'll have some sort of issue, and because there's a whole, like I said, there's a whole, like, cascade of chemicals that can be used to initiate clotting or coagulation. If you coagulate too often or too much, you're coagulating in your blood vessels.
Oh.
And then you're dead.
Right.
You know, so that's like a DVT, not DVT necessarily, but a DVT would be an example of inappropriate clotting. And then, so that's like down in your legs, you know, you went on this long flight or whatever, you get a DVT, a clot in your
legs. Oh, and then it goes in your brain and you die.
Yeah. Or it goes into your lungs or it goes into your heart or whatever. So, yes, there is, but we don't really...
We don't talk about it that much.
The other thing that I think is really cool is once the clot is big enough to stop the bleeding, going back to where we kind of left off, those endothelial cells are they actually release nitric oxide and prostacyclins, and that inhibits the coagulation cascade. So it does its own like self-regulation, saying, you know, we're good.
Turn off.
Yep. And nitrous oxide is a vasodilator, so it'll help so that we can resume regular blood flow where that cut was. Just real quick, coagulation cascade, we kind of started talking about being complicated. I'll give you a little bit more. There's an extrinsic and an intrinsic pathway. The extrinsic happens when blood vessels are damaged to the point that not just the endothelium, but the actual wall of the vessel is damaged. It's initiated within seconds, so it's a really quick, rapid onset, where we also have intrinsic, which is just for, like, kind of more like skin damage, and takes several minutes to take place, and that's started by our von Willebrand factor. But then there's this, like, common pathway that they both go through. I just realized once I said that, that's probably really boring for most people.
Yeah, okay, here's my question. I've got a cut on something that's important.
Okay.
You know, like an important, like a big vein, right?
Yeah.
And like, and it's like doing that like thing, like it happens in the movies where it goes.
Oh, psh, yeah. Psh, psh, psh. So that's.
And so wait, hold on. And so I've got a big blanket or a towel over like my femoral artery or whatever.
Right.
But while it's clotting, like that one's big enough that you can't make a detour in your blood. Stream.
Oh, yeah.
And so then, like, there's a little bit still going through while it's still clotting. Like, it's still, like, letting cars through on the freeway.
Yeah.
But it's maybe only one lane. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So the reason it spurts is because it's a big artery.
Mm-hmm.
And so that spurting is going on with your heartbeat.
Yeah.
Right? And so it would still vasoconstrict. But like you said, it's such a big vessel that's just a lot of area that, you would have to try and block off essentially. In fact, when you look at like, old dueling, instructional, like papyrus, like,
sure. Yeah.
Because I got kind of nerdy about some, medieval sword fighting for a while. A lot of them talk about trying to cut the femoral artery because it's an easy one to get to.
Oh.
You know, and that's actually, who was it? It was, wasn't it Edward de Vere, the actual author of the Shakespearean plays, who I think as a kid accidentally killed his dueling instructor when he cut open the femoral artery.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That he sort of slipped and gave him a real cut. It was something along those lines. The thing to note though is that while your femoral artery is not giving blood off to where it's supposed to, there are, and I think we've talked about these, anastomoses, which are blood vessels from two different pathways essentially that are nearby each other. So while it's not sending blood, all the blood it should through the femoral artery, it would also send blood through other arteries to try and balance out.
Cool.
So I suppose that's probably everything that we should talk about, huh?
Yeah. Make sure you check us out on artofmedschool.com. We have a ton of more information, blog posts, any of our past episodes that you might have missed, as well as some really fun underwater photography that Mike has been working on. There's some cute photos of fish. So check us out on artofmedschool.com. Hey, good looking. What you got cooking?
You're talking to me?
Yeah. You made breakfast this morning.
Yeah, but you don't like my food.
You made really good food when we were dating. And then, like, the moment we got engaged, you, like, forgot how to cook.
That's not true at all.
Oh, my gosh, it's so
true. What's true is that I like creamy dishes, and you like acidic dishes. I do mostly creamy cooking, like cream-based or, you know, not so much tomatoes and stuff, and that's what you prefer.
That's true. I got a really good deal on tomatoes yesterday, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, but we'll get to that later. So, this section is all about the food we eat when we're here. We'll do another one, I promise, about some of the local dishes and the regional food that we've been eating while we're here, but this is more of like, it's a Tuesday afternoon, what am I having for lunch? Or it's a Thursday night, what are we eating? You know, because we don't go out to eat very much.
No, we don't. Even though it can be pretty reasonable to go out to eat.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the larger size in some shops are 10 UC, so that's like $4.
Yeah, so I mean, it's really not that bad to eat out, but I think we like eating in. And it does end up being cheaper in the long run.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, but food here is pretty expensive. That since we are on an island, a lot of things are imported rather than produced here, you know?
Yep.
That they just can't grow everything here, and they don't have the right soil to make everything here. So, you know, all of the wheat and all of the rice and all of that stuff, that isn't produced here. It's brought in.
Yeah.
I mean, most of the fruits and vegetables that we get are produced here. But main staples and anything packaged, for the most part, beyond like pepper sauce, is brought in.
It's sort of basically anything that you don't buy from a street vendor, right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't get a lot of local produce or local goods, rather, in a grocery store.
I think that's pretty fair. That's a pretty fair assessment, yeah.
That being said, there's street vendors all over the place.
All over the place, yeah, selling mostly fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, yeah. I had some pretty decent roasted corn last night.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Nice. So, what the fruits and vegetables I find to be really pretty good, but the meat here,
oof,
it sucks.
You know, the I'm getting used to the chicken, because, like, it's just... The thing is, I think in all food, there's no preservatives or anything, really.
Yeah.
Like, our fruits and our vegetables don't last as long as they do back home. Our bread certainly doesn't last as long.
No, not at all.
And the meat isn't as meaty as I'm used to, but I think it's because of the way that it's grown.
I don't know. It was really hard to find, like, chicken breasts and stuff like that for a while until I kind of figured out where to look inside the grocery store. There's still... The grocery store right by your school doesn't carry chicken breasts at all.
No.
That most locals like eating chicken off the bone. So I've been finding chicken breasts, and they're all imported from the U.S.
Oh, really?
But they're probably not the same quality as that.
I guess we haven't tried them.
I don't know. It's not the same level of... Because when I cook them, I'm like, this is tough, and this is a little freezer burnt and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, I've not heard good things about the beef either.
I don't know, that one time that I made you the poutine.
Yeah, it was tough, but it was okay.
Yeah,
it was nice. Tougher, I should say.
Yeah. But I mean, we're pretty spoiled.
Yeah, yeah, coming from South Dakota with beef in the family.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. But, so, we some meat, but we don't eat as much as we have in the past. Not nearly. Yeah. So what I try to do is...
Oh, we actually eat a lot of... For meat, we eat a lot of chicken salami.
Yeah. There's this chicken salami that we get that is kind of weird.
Very weird.
It doesn't have, like, an outer casing on it. But it comes... Yeah, it comes in this can, like Spam. But it's long. And... Yeah, we put it in a lot of stuff.
And it's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
There's something weird, though, about eating... Like, we cut it up and put it in our eggs, like, omelet style. There's always something weird to me about mixing chicken and eggs. It's kind of like having pork, like, pork loins wrapped in bacon.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying.
Or steak bites, like, steak tips encased in burger.
You would totally eat that.
Totally sounds good.
Yeah, I'm like, he's like, why? You don't think that sounds weird at all. You just think it sounds weird that you haven't had it yet.
That's true.
But now, especially that I'm working, that I've been doing a lot more make ahead sort of stuff to help us kind of both out, you know? That when you're going to school, especially if you don't have somebody that enjoys cooking like myself around, you know, that... If you're going to school, you need to be focusing on going to school. You shouldn't necessarily... If it's not something you enjoy, if it's not something you find relaxing, then you should maybe find another way to eat.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a weird idea that... especially with medical school, and definitely other schools too, that everything has to be super high yield. And by high yield, we just mean that, like, it's the best... highest return on that investment of time that you can get, you know? So we talk about high yield studying where you just kind of futzing around studying, reading things that you're not really getting anything out of. That's not high yield, but doing, you know, question banks or whatever that helps you really understand, that's high yield. It's the same thing with your downtime. If your type of high yield downtime is going to the beach, you better... When you're done studying, go to the beach and not...
And really, don't bring a book with you.
Yeah, and don't screw around in between because that's not high yield. You're not getting the highest return on that investment. So if you're not enjoying cooking or if it's not downtime feeling for you, that takes, you know, between grocery shopping and the actual cooking, that's probably 10 hours a week.
Yeah.
So 10 hours a week times 4, that's an entire... full times work, you know, a whole work week that you're taking away from your month of studying, you know, and that's a significant amount of time.
Yeah, that is, yeah, that you could be spending better. But if you find it relaxing, do it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I personally find cooking relaxing, and so I love doing it, and so it makes me happy.
I used to, and then I got married to someone who didn't like my cooking.
Well, that's because you don't cook very well. Actually... Like, you know, you cooked really great before we got married. Anyway, so some of the things that I like to make here.
You're so mean.
I know. Only on the inside for most of the time. Anyway, some of the things that I like to make when I'm here is I like to make burritos. But burritos aren't exactly a thing that exists here. Like at work, we do tacos on Fridays. But I come in with a burrito and they look at me and they're like, what is that? But what's in there? And then like, they're all looking at me and I take a bite. Like, I'm like, I'm not going to eat if you guys are watching me. Anyway, because you're able to find all of the stuff to go in a burrito, except for maybe cilantro. I hear that they have it, but I haven't really seen it yet.
It's somewhere out there.
It's somewhere out there. But they don't have burrito wraps, but I found tortillas. Thank you. But they make this food called roti, and it's kind of like a curry burrito, which is super awesome. We're going to do another podcast all about the local awesome food that I've been able to eat. But I use the skins for that to make my burritos, and it works out really great. I also make and I can just throw those burritos in the freezer, and in the morning we can just throw them in our bag, and away we go.
Yeah, that's the best part to me, and they don't entirely. Like, then they're thawed by lunch, so it's not terribly hard to reheat or anything.
Yeah. I also make these sandwich rolls that are almost like calzones.
Yeah, I really like those.
And I put, like, the chicken salami or chicken itself in there, and I this one's a little bit more labor intensive because I actually make a yeast dough.
Yeah.
For it to go in.
I like to think of them more as like variants on Fleischkekla than calzones, though.
That's fair.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a variant. It's a sandwich pocket.
Yeah.
And it works out, and it works out great. I also make like rice and beans. That's easy to find around here.
Yeah. You do like a jerk chicken rice bake sort of thing the other day.
Yeah, I did.
And then we could just scoop that out into Tupperware.
Mm-hmm. I also made chili. That was really easy.
Yeah.
I make a lot of like Italian pasta salads that you can eat either cold or hot.
That I like because then, like, especially on busy days, I don't have to take time to heat things up.
Yeah.
I can study that entire lunch break instead of, you know, because, you know, you only take a couple minutes. Maybe it's 5 minutes to go down and heat it up and come back up, but then it's an extra 5 minutes of waiting for your turn at the microwave. Pretty soon out of an hour, you're down to 45 minutes and you've lost 25% of your break.
Yeah. So it, you know, trying to make things as simple as possible. So that's what works for us. I'll make big pots of food and we'll just kind of on like my day off and then we'll kind of eat off of it for the whole week. I've got a big cooking day today.
I sometimes feel like my grandma because the Tupperware that we got with the house that we rented isn't very good. Like, it just doesn't seal very well. And I'm always a little paranoid about things coming apart and getting all over in my bag anyhow. So a lot of our Tupperwares are, like, old Cool Whip containers.
Yep.
Or, like, a tub of butter that we save for the tub.
Yep.
Shoot, even most of the stuff that we take, like, to the beach, we fill up a bunch of 20-ounce bottle, like, pop bottles with water, freeze them, and we use that for ice instead of picking up ice, because picking up ice is really expensive.
Yeah.
And then I'll, like, even in my lunch bag, I'll throw a 20-ounce thing of water frozen, and then it's thawed by lunch.
It's thawed by lunch.
Yeah.
So, another difficult thing, like we were saying, is that there's often scarcity or shortages of food. Because we're on this island, and sometimes the ship doesn't come in, or sometimes it comes in and it doesn't pass customs, or I don't know why.
No chicken wings for 2 weeks.
Yeah. And this is a country that loves their chicken wings.
Yep.
And they're really good.
They are really good.
But, so going to the store with a big plan in my mind, or going on the street trying to find something, it just sometimes doesn't have to work out. So you have to be flexible.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Like, there's some things that you can always find, like rice and dried beans.
Yep.
You can always have beans and rice.
Yep.
But there's a lot of times where you're like, I really want to find green peppers today. And there's just sometimes when they're not in season. And that's also a really good lesson, is that as Americans, you can always buy whatever you want because it's
right.
America.
Yeah.
But that, you know, food actually has a season, and it's good to eat it when it's in season.
Yeah. Well, and isn't there something, too, where our local friend Serena was telling us that something happened with the weather, or it was rainy in December, but all of the sweet peppers and the hot peppers essentially crossbred, and so now there are no sweet peppers and there are no hot peppers, but there are sweet hot peppers.
Yeah.
For this year, you know.
Yeah. Something really similar to that. So it's kind of weird how that works. I don't know. So, but as we said, if cooking isn't your thing, if it's not something that you find enjoyable, there are some economically feasible ways to not even have to cook when you're here.
Yeah. It's a friend of mine at school, Alex. He lives next to an elementary school, I think, and pays them X amount of dollars. And every night when he gets home, he's got supper ready for him. It's whatever their lunch was for that day.
And the day that I worked at an elementary school, the food that they had there was really good.
Yeah.
It wasn't like
American
chicken patty on a bun with mayo. You know, it was actual food.
Yeah. Even, you know, we're looking at Jen going back to the States for a little bit, and I've already talked to the rum shop here, and we're looking at working out a way where I can stop at the rum shop after school, and I've got fresh supper ready to go, and I've got a to-go container that I can take of that same meal that I can take to lunch the next day.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's ways to go around it, but that's what's cooking. Hey.
Last week, we launched our Patreon account. Please go check it out. You can find a link on our website or just look up Art of Med School on patreon.com. This is a great way to support us as we work hard to make the most and best content possible. You can find more information on our homepage at artofmedschool.com. And every little bit helps. Thanks.
All right, so it's kind of funny that we're talking about, or that we did some talking about food, because I didn't know that that was your plan.
I could sense that it was yours.
Oof. Oof. Well, anyway, I thought it would be neat to talk about some special senses things. And special senses are basically like your five senses, you know? So, in no real order or anything, let's talk about ears. So you know the basics of how your ear works, right? Like sound goes into your ear and it moves those little bones and they vibrate against an oval window, like a window into that transmits those vibrations into fluid, which moves hairs back and forth, which turns it into an electrical signal.
It whips your hair back and forth. Yes. Okay. Yes, I remember this.
So There's an oval window, and then there's a round window, which is essentially at the other end of where that fluid is. And that round window, its job is to amplify the sound.
Okay.
In fact, that signal that goes into our ears gets amplified like 20 to 30 times.
Really?
Yeah.
So we live in a really quiet world.
Well, much quieter than how we perceive it.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So that round window also has a secondary tympanic membrane covering it that helps to absorb the sound. So if it gets amplified too much, it helps to suck some of that up.
Okay.
So that we don't hurt our ears, right? Because really, sound is just energy, right? Like sound they're waves of energy, they're oscillations of displaced energy and time that we perceive and turn into electrical signals, right?
Sure.
So like at a loud concert, that membrane has to absorb a lot of energy because that energy gets absorbed so we don't,
yeah.
It's not too loud, right? But what's crazy is that membrane can hold so it holds the energy and it lets it dissipate at a safe rate. So think of like you're at a loud rock concert, all that sound waves goes into your ear, gets to this membrane. That membrane's like, this is too much. And it holds it and it's holding all this energy. So it's essentially just sitting there vibrating and letting it off piece by piece.
Is that why your ears ring?
Okay, well, I guess that was a spoiler alert.
Oh.
Yeah, that's...
You left me there and you helped me figure it out for myself.
That's why I will just cut that part of the script. So, yeah, that's why, like, you've absorbed so much energy that it can take literally days. Like, it'll hold the energy for days to let it all go. And that's why we have ears ringing.
That's really cool. Don't be so disappointed.
Uh-huh. All right. So next one. All right. The lens of your eyes, right? So, your eye lens, right? It kind of floats there in the middle of your eye. And it's connected with these suspensory ligaments, like these just thin protein ligaments that hold onto that lens and attach it to a couple of very, very small muscles around the sides.
Yeah, yeah.
And those muscles contract and pull those ligaments to either flatten it or to make it more rounded, depending on how far away something is that we want to see. So the flatter it is...
Sure.
We can see further away. The rounder it is, we can see close up. Okay, and we call that accommodation. Your lens accommodates for your where you want to see things. What's interesting, I think, is that astigmatism, nearsightedness, farsightedness, is actually related to the shape of our eye, and the lens inability to accommodate for that shape.
Oh.
So it's not that our lens
is
bad.
We all got a standard size lens, but not standard size eyeballs.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, so like that's why my eyeballs are shaped the wrong way. That's why I need glasses.
I think your eyeballs are just perfect the way they are.
Now, on the flip side, as you get older and you start needing reading glasses, that's called presbyopia.
Mm.
And the lens itself is, there's some collagen in there, and that collagen starts to get hard.
Sure, okay.
And so the lens loses its elasticity and its ability to essentially get round.
Okay.
So if it can't get round, you can't see close up, and then you start to need reading glasses. But it can still, I mean, it's more, it can flatten out a little bit, so you can still see farther
far
away.
Huh.
And that's why, as you get older, people, 99% need better, or they need reading glasses. All right, so this last one, it's kind of a long one, I think is really interesting. I'd like to do more research into it, but technically, spice is not a flavor.
Oh. Is it a feeling?
Sort of. So we have specialized
it's
buds.
It's definitely not a sound.
We have specialized buds for like sweet, sour,
bitter,
salty. And we also have that one called umami now, which is in more like recent development. I don't know.
Yeah, like they say that it's just Japanese for yummy. And it's like that, like, savory.
It's savory, yeah.
Deliciousness.
But it's actually related, and we know what it's related to. It's related to a molecule called monosodium glutamate.
I love MSG so much.
Yeah, right? So it's that savory.
I know it's
taste
fatty,
of,
but I love it so much.
I don't know that it's that fatty. I know people can be sensitive to it, but. So the savory taste of monosodium glutamate, but we don't actually have one dedicated to spicy.
Okay.
You know what we use to detect spicy?
There's like a number.
That flavor we detect in spicy foods is actually stimulated or signals from our pain receptors.
What? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that hurts so good.
Yeah, so when you eat spicy, it's not that you're tasting spicy. You're actually literally hurting yourself. So
Eating
spicy food is really just sort of a form of masochism.
I don't mind. If that's wrong, I don't want to be right.
But
that's cool. I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, it's a neat idea. So to get, and this is where I think it gets more interesting. The pain sensation from spicy is usually related to an organic chemical called I can't say this word, and I tried it so many times. Capsaicin.
Capsaicin? I don't know.
It's a whole scale, and I'm sure we've got spicy.
Capsaicin? I don't know. My Aunt Sandy makes this sauce called Capsaicin Sensation, and it's like a spicy sauce.
Yeah.
It's really good, but it's really sweet, too.
So you were talking about the scale, the numeric scale. That's what it relates to, is the heat based off of how much capsaicin it has. What's crazy is that it doesn't actually hurt you.
You can't hurt yourself from eating too much spicy?
Well, don't take it that far. Capsaicin doesn't hurt you.
Okay.
It just causes those pain receptors, those things that feel pain, to send signals. But it doesn't actually hurt you.
Huh.
So you have all these little pain, like pain detectors on your tongue or whatever. It turns them on, but it doesn't do any actual damage. So that's why you can eat a bunch of spicy food that makes your mouth burn, but you don't have any burns in your mouth.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, I think the caveat would be don't take it to the point where spicy food can't hurt you, because you can, like, You are enacting pain receptors that can enact a response to pain. which could be, you know, the release of histamines, which causes, vasodilation, bronchodilation, you know.
So, yeah, that I hear that the biggest problem is if you're, you know, working with spicy peppers is the inhalation.
Yeah.
And so then it, you know, makes it so you can't breathe.
Yep.
And breathing's important.
It is. It is. But it's really your body's response to this sort of fake pain signal that is the danger, not the
injury itself.
Yeah, because there is no injury.
That's wild.
Yeah. And so that's the other thing that's kind of really interesting is that, so while this stimulates pain, it actually eventually decreases the intensity of the pain signals. That's why people who eat a lot of spicy food can eat more spicy food or spicier food than others, because that chemical actually lowers the amount of pain signal that gets sent over time.
Huh.
Now, what's really cool, and this is what I feel like I want to do more research into, is that they package capsaicin into a cream. And they're now starting to use it to help degenerate pain stimuli for essentially chronic pain disorders.
Why would you do that?
Because.
Why would you give people more pain?
Because of its ability to long-term lower the amount of pain signals sent. So, for instance, I have chronic arthritis in my wrist.
Yes.
From, a bad accident when I was younger. I have pain in it every day. I could take that capsaicin cream, rub it into my wrist, and it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
I do it the next day. It's going to hurt. I do it the next day. It hurts a little bit less, and then a little bit less, and then a little bit less. But basically what you're doing is you're training those pain receptors to not send so many pain signals.
Sure.
And so over time, and I'm not...
Just make sure to wear a glove so you don't, with the hand that you're rubbing on the lotion, that you're not doing that for your fingers too, so you won't hurt yourself.
So over time, I can train them to not send so many pain signals, and it makes my arthritis better.
That's cool.
It doesn't actually do anything to fix my arthritis. It's just sending less pain signals.
Wow.
Yeah, right? So it's used for, like, after surgery, people with neuropathy or neuralgia issues, you know, like nervous system issues, chronic headaches, things like that.
All right.
Our theme music, Urbana Metronica Wuya Mix by Spinning Mercata, is copyright 2011, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. This show is not affiliated or endorsed in any way by St. James School of Medicine. Micah just goes there. The Art of Med School podcast is part of the Art of Med School Network. For more information, find us on the web at artofmedschool.com.